Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network and publish a nationally distributed print magazine. And now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is at BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. I'm delighted to announce that this series of Serious Influence is being exclusively sponsored by our very own tech platform, the Blogosphere Network. The Blogosphere Network is a platform where brands and influencers can feedback on what it was actually like to work with each other on campaigns. Real, qualitative data. If you'd like a demo of the service, please drop us an email at info@blogosphere.biz. That's info@blogosphere.biz. It's time to bring back the human touch to this human industry. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Steph Yeboah from plus-size blog Nerd About Town. Steph is a body positivity advocate and, in addition to creating fashion, beauty and lifestyle content, uses her social platforms to educate others on the body positivity movement. Steph has worked on both sides of the influencer industry and has seen its evolution firsthand.
I am a plus size blogger, writer and owner of blog Nerd About Town. And on Twitter, I am at Nerd About Town. On Instagram, I am at Nerd About Town too.
And how did you first get into the world of social media? And if we're looking at your career history, and I suppose we can go into trajectory as well, what does that look like?
I was actually on Twitter in 2006, so I think when it first started, yeah. So I was there from the very beginning where I didn't really realise what I was doing. And I had that account and it was dormant for a couple of years because I was just like, what is this new thing? Why am I talking to myself? It's weird. So it wasn't until 2008 when I was in my second year of uni. I was doing a law degree and I hated it because I felt like I had been pushed into doing law by my parents. And so I started a blog on LiveJournal, basically documenting how I hated my course and degree. I hated everyone. I hated the teachers and all of these things. And me and my friends at uni would read each other's blogs and comment and laugh and things like that. And then I moved on to Blogger, the Blogger platform. And then I realized that I started to talk a lot more about beauty and skin products for darker skins and foundations and things like that for darker skin tones. So for a good 2 to 3 years, I started off as a beauty and skincare blogger. And then sort of 2014, I started incorporating a lot of fashion into my blog posts. And that was when I began to utilize social media a lot more. So before I started getting serious with my blog, I would use social media as a way to just retweet memes and, you know, talk to friends and family and things like that. But then as soon as I realized that I wanted to get a lot more serious about my branding of my blog, because I could potentially see that it was going somewhere, I renamed my username to Nerd About Town, and then I started syncing my social media to my blog and broadcasting the newest blog posts and things like that. And so I think once I started incorporating the fashion, that's where my blog began to take off. And so, yeah, it's just been going ever since.
And were you working alongside your blog at that time?
Yes. So up until recently, I've been working full time while doing the blog on the side on the weekends and after work and during lunchtime as well.
What was the job that you were working in?
Oh gosh. So when I first started, I was in uni, then I graduated and I didn't want to do law. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I started temping. So I was working as a medical secretary, and then I was a clinical coordinator for a hospital. And then I worked in an advertising agency, because at this time I was thinking to myself, okay, so I've got this blog and I work with PRs, and PR, you know, sounds like a really cool job. And, you know, you get to have like samples and you get to work with all of these influencers and other brands and talk to journalists and things like that. So maybe that might be a thing that I wanted to explore. So I tried to get into the marketing field. So I worked at a marketing company. I was briefly a wardrobe stylist for like 6 months. That was a really random random part of my life where I was doing some styling for like Kelly Rowland and Nicki Minaj and things like that. But then it was a bit too demanding for me and a bit toxic. So
in what kind of way do you find
just
it?
In terms of, I guess, the way I was treated as somebody whose body doesn't fit in with the standards of beauty, the way I would be looked at by, you know, some of the journalists. And if I was calling for pieces, they would, you know, look at me first. And sometimes I'd get snide comments, and I just didn't really like that kind of culture.
Did that inspire you to talk a bit more about that on your blog in terms of body positivity and that movement?
At the time, it didn't, only because during that time, I was still very, very heavily insecure. And I was, so everything that they were saying to me and everything that I was experiencing in my head, I agreed with. So I was still at that point where I was like, oh yeah, well, I must be this. And I must be too big for this. And maybe I shouldn't be in this job role. And maybe I shouldn't. So then I took that sort of criticism and internalized it. And so I left it, which, looking back, I shouldn't have done. But because I was still in that mindset of feeling very low about myself and having low self-esteem, I just left that position, went into marketing, which was amazing. I loved it.
What kind of things were you involved in marketing? And is that when you had your first experience of the other side of the table and being able to work with influencers so you could see both sides? And also, you mentioned PR earlier, but did you have budget to be able to allocate to influencers?
Oh, so my first insight into marketing, I was actually on reception at a really big marketing company. And I wasn't directly involved, but I was working alongside all of the different marketing agencies within this company. So I was able to see the behind the scenes in terms of seeing the celebrities come in and seeing the way storyboards were created and seeing an advert, you know, from its inception to, you know, coming to life and then winning awards for it. And it was amazing. And that's what spurred me on to get into the marketing world. So I eventually started off as a PR intern for 3 months, and then I was promoted to PR executive and then digital strategist. And so it was my job to introduce the influencer marketing department into the marketing agency I was with. And I'm not going to lie, it was very, very difficult, because I think one of the reasons they took me on is because they knew that I was an influencer anyway. So they thought I could offer that expertise.
And what year are we in now as well that this is happening?
Oh, so this was within the last year or so. So up until then, I'd been working at some marketing agencies just trying to get experience.
So did they think then, because you were already a blogger and that you already had those relationships with other bloggers, that you would be better positioned to try and get kind of free content? Is that what they thought? Or were you given budget to use?
So it wasn't the marketing company that thought that. They liked the fact that I had the expertise, but it was more the clients. So I would explain at length to my managers and people within the agency that, you know, if you want to work with influencers, there needs to be some kind of budget available, because there are a lot of influencers now that are going freelance and going full time, and it's a huge industry. So they were all very understanding of it. But when it came to persuading the clients to, and some of them were very small clients, it's a very small agency that I worked for, like a boutique agency. So all of the clients were still very small. And I just remember just days of like email threads going back and forth with some of the clients, you know, and saying they want 60 or 70 pieces of coverage a month from influencers. And they would send out the product. And then when I would ask, okay, so what's the budget for this campaign? They would say, we don't have a budget. They're getting the product. What more do you want? And then I'd have to sit back from the computer and just like breathe and just be like, okay, how can I explain it to them without coming across as being, you know, like as if I'm talking down to them almost? So it did take a long time to convince some of the brands to create a budget. But in the end, a little bit before I left, I was able to create like a document and sort of talk about what influencer marketing is and how powerful of a tool it is in regards to marketing, and kind of added some facts and figures and sort of sent it around to a lot of the clients. So there were like 3 or 4 clients that did opt in to put some budget behind some of the campaigns, which I'm really happy about.
Do you think that the resistance that you faced was mainly through just lack of education around influencer marketing and that it was this sort of new industry?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a lot of, especially when it comes to some of the brands that have been around for a really long time, they perhaps cater to a specific audience, maybe like mid-30s, 40s. So a lot of our brands was sort of within that range of baby boomers, Generation X almost. So they didn't really understand, you know, the millennial audience and the fact that we've got a whole new form of media, which isn't advertising directly. It's, you know, people that are genuinely talking about a product that they love. And a lot of them just didn't understand it at all. So, you know, I had to go about doing a lot of research and speaking to other influencers and creating a whole new document on our system about influencer marketing and why it's so impactful. And I think when we started it with a couple of the brands that we were working with and they saw, you know, the great results from a couple of the influencers, that's when they wanted to make it the majority of their budget,
yeah,
which was really, really good.
What was the most successful campaign that you worked on when you were at that agency and what made it successful?
So one of the campaigns that I worked on, and it was actually one of the campaigns that I done, not completely alone, but without sort of somebody on my neck almost. Yeah. So it was working with this tourism board in West London, and they wanted exposure and they wanted people to visit their website about this trail that families could do in West London. So whether it's going to the Museum of Water and Steam or going to all of these beautiful grand houses in Southwest London, because they wanted to increase the amount of people going to West London to, I guess, do all of their tourism stuff, because I think people tend to just go to West End and then they go to like East London and all of the, you know, the prominent spots that people tend to go to. So they want Southwest London, they wanted a bit of love. And so they came to us and they said, we want to do a complete influencer campaign and we want influencers to write a review about a visit to one of our grand houses for a tour. So what we did was I drew up a media list of some influencers based in Southwest London and then also some influencers that were sort of based in London in general. And I worked with my intern on this. And we hit up all of these influencers and we talked about, you know, why this would be such a great event to come to. We organized all of like the canapes and the cocktails, and because where the influencers were going to, it's like a really grand, beautiful house in Strawberry Hill.
Yeah.
And they do twilight tours and like a gothic tour. So the actual building, the reason I wanted to have it there, because they gave me a pick of buildings to go to. And I said, no, we have to go to Strawberry Hill House because Strawberry Hill House is Instagrammable. It's a beautiful, huge, white gothic house. And I just know that influencers are going to want to take pictures in front of it.
Had they kind of thought that through, or, you know, that actually picking somewhere that is Instagrammable is going to make your campaign kind of more successful? Or did you feel that you were educating them in that respect?
Oh, yeah, definitely educating them. Because I think they wanted to go to a museum that wasn't on the outside of it wasn't anything special. But then I was like, look, we need to get the grandest house because we need to take into account that, you know, influencers are going to want to take pictures and create content. They've got like a beautiful garden. So I spoke to them about using this house. The house agreed, which was great. We organized all of the tours and everything, and we had some of the influencers and some of the influencers' families coming to the house and gardens to have this tour. And at first, it was only supposed to be like a social media campaign. So what we wanted the influencers to do was to just create social media content. So Instagram stories, Instagram posts, Twitter posts, those kind of things with the link to this tourism board. And I remember the influencers came in and they all just ran off to the garden in droves because it's such a beautiful garden and there's loads of symmetry and things like that. And they were all just taking pictures and doing their outfit photos and tagging Strawberry Hill House, which was amazing. But the thing that I think made it really successful was that even though the aim of the campaign was to get social media coverage, in the end, we got 47 blog posts as well.
Wow.
So they went above and beyond what we were expecting. But I think a lot of it was because of the location and the quality of the tours and just me and my colleagues sort of interacting with the bloggers and, you know, introducing them to the tourism board and just having that good relationship during the day, that they were all just so mind blown by the event that they all wrote about it and they were very happy. The client was very, very happy about that.
Do you think that doing events is one of the best ways for brands to get that kind of coverage and that sometimes it feels more authentic? Because I suppose those influencers are invited to an experience, but they're not paid to post.
I personally, as an influencer, I love going to events because I find it a great way to not only get education on the client and what their service or product they're offering to me is. But then I can also network with other influencers, network with the brand, and just have that immersive experience. So as opposed to a brand sending me something out and then asking me to write about it, sometimes it's really nice to just be in their space and actually use the product or service and look at it and have a thorough understanding of what the product and service is. And a lot of the time I do prefer sort of going to an event and just being immersed in what the product is, and then just getting to know the clients as well, getting to know the brand is sometimes really, really good.
How important do you think direct relationships are? And in a world where more people are increasing spend on third-party platforms, actually having a more strategic partnership with influencers, what are your views on that?
In terms of the brands having...
Well, brands having direct relationships and kind of talking one-on-one, so a brand and an influencer, and talking about the campaign, as opposed to putting X amount of budget into a platform that has X engagement rate.
I think it's really, really important, because then you get to have this long-standing relationship with this brand. You know, there are brands that I've worked with like since like 2014, 2013, and I still have that relationship with them today. My only thing with that is that I think it's important to keep that professionalism as well, because I think when you get to know a brand or a particular person or a particular PR from the brand, it's very easy to, you know, be very colloquial with them and, you know, hang out with them outside of work times and things like that. But then I think it's also important to establish that professional line as well, just in case, you know, they've asked you to do a campaign and you're not happy with it, or there's some sort of conflict and it can be a bit difficult to kind of approach if you guys are too friendly. That's where it can get awkward. But I think in terms of maintaining relationships with bloggers, I think influencers appreciate it a lot more if they've got that one-to-one personal relationship, because then it shows that the brand are deeply invested in that creator's content and that they value that creator's content so much so that they've personally gone out of their way to contact that person.
What was the first branded campaign that you ever did?
The first branded campaign I did was in 2014, and it was with Simply Be, and that was a photo shoot for a summer campaign. That was the first time I've ever done like any sort of photo shoot, and I think I was very shocked when I was approached, because I'd literally just started doing plus size fashion and I just didn't think anybody knew me. So when I got the email, I was a bit like, what, me? Why would you want me in this? Like, it was just really overwhelming and amazing. And that was a photo shoot that was really great. And then some of the newspapers picked it up and it was on like Simply Be's front page and things like that. So that was like a really overwhelming experience.
In terms of the campaigns that land in your inbox now, do you spend, obviously you've left the agency and you've just gone full time. Do you find that you... kind of what percentage of your time is spent pitching to brands as opposed to reacting to pitches that land in your inbox?
I would say at the moment it's kind of like, do you know what? I think it's probably like 60-40. So the 60% is receiving campaigns from brands. I think that's only because I've kind of just announced that I've gone freelance. So a lot of the brands are like pouncing on before it's too late. So I think once I've done it for a couple of months, it will be a lot more of me pitching out. But the first week or so after I announced that I was going freelance, I spent that whole week just pitching out. So not only do I pitch out to brands, but I pitch out to publications as well, because I do some writing. It's really humbling. It's a really nice experience to kind of feel like a brand is coming to you because they want you to do this work for them.
What's the best kind of pitch that lands in your inbox in terms of structure? Say if you've got a brand that you've never worked with before and they're cold emailing you, what do they need to say in that email to get your attention and for you to potentially do it?
It would need to be relevant to what I do. So I have had pitches before from brands where they've asked me to review a diet tea. And for me, as somebody that is a plus size influencer, that's all about body positivity, it lets me know that they don't know anything about my content. They've just copied and pasted an email and just sending it out to whoever. And I don't really appreciate that. So I think if they have really done their homework on my content, my blog, the things that I'm passionate about talking about, and they sort of mention it within the first two paragraphs or so, then it really catches my attention. And then as long as the pitching is like, I guess, really clear and concise in what they want me to do exactly, because sometimes some pitches can be quite vague, and sometimes brands will ask you to do more than what you first thought you needed to do, and they don't mention it until like the very last minute. So I'm a fan of like a clear outline of what the pitch wants me to do. And then thirdly, the budget. It'd be nice to know what budget they have available.
Do you find that brands often put that in the first email or not?
No, I always have to ask. There are some brands actually that are quite good, and they'll say, let me know what your rate is for that, and then we'll talk it out afterwards. But for a lot of the time, especially with like the smaller brands as well, they never mention it. So it's like a case of me, you know, replying, saying, this sounds like a great campaign, I would love to work with you, can I ask what your budget is? And then I don't hear back.
How do you determine what your rates are? Do you have like a rate pack, or is it bespoke because the campaigns are bespoke? And do you ever kind of go back and say, but I think actually it would, this campaign would benefit from having an Instagram story? Or
So a lot of mine are bespoke, just because it really varies the kind of content that some brands want me to do. So one of the things that I think is really difficult about rates within the influencer community is that nobody really likes to speak about it a lot. It's still quite taboo because nobody wants anybody else to know how much they charge. And I think if we were a lot more transparent in this area, it would encourage influencers to kind of price their rates accordingly, and hopefully there wouldn't be too much confusion in that area. There have been times when a brand has asked me to maybe create like an Instagram story or a static Instagram post, and I would say, look, I have X amount of followers that read my blog as well. I really feel like I could expand on this subject in greater depth. How would you feel about me creating a blog post to go with this? Or how would you feel about me maybe doing like a YouTube video, or just, you know, added extras just so that they can have an option of the kind of things that I can do. When I first started out, I had absolutely no idea how to rate. And I would always ask other influencers who had been influencing longer than me, you know, what should I rate? This was my rate. And every time I said it, they came back and said, Steph, you are undervaluing yourself too much. You should be charging this. And so for the longest time, when I first started out, I was pricing myself according to what other influencers had told me to price myself as. But I think it's a case of just getting to understand your worth. And
do you think that that links into confidence as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's having the confidence to know that, because I think the whole influencer world is, it's very oversaturated. So there are loads and loads and loads of people doing similar things to you. And so sometimes it can be quite nerve-wracking to kind of think to yourself, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't price myself at this because this person does this, or this person uses GIFs in their content. Or, you know, you find yourself comparing yourself to people a lot. And sometimes if you're not confident in your work, you tend to undervalue what you're doing and charge like a little amount.
That can also be a race to the bottom. If people are undercutting each other, you're just going to get less and less, and then it's not actually a viable career path.
Exactly. And I think it's important for micro influencers as well to charge, because now that I think about it, I sometimes ask myself, how did I allow it to go on for so long? But I only started charging for my content last year, and I've been blogging for 10 years, and that was because I had no confidence in what I was doing. Even though I had people saying, Steph, you're such a good writer and you create such good content, I would look at my Instagram numbers and compare it to other plus size influencers in the game who are far higher. And I would think, oh, well, my content isn't good. This must mean, you know, nobody's following me, or I'm not getting the engagement that this person is getting. So that must mean I should price myself lower or not at all. And it was like that for a long time. And it was only because of my confidence. I just didn't think that I had what it took to be a good writer or a good blogger. And over the past year, I've been working on my writing a lot, and just trying to increase my confidence in general. And with that, I've finally gotten to a point where I know my worth, and I know that I do create good content and that I should charge accordingly for it. Because you kind of have to think about it as, if this brand or this agency were to go to a modeling agency, or they wanted to take out like a full page in a newspaper, they'll be paying thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds for that. So you know that they've got the budget. So sometimes don't be scared to name your price of what you think you're worth, because that same brand will probably have that budget anyway, because they probably would at some point use that for like official print advertising or things like that.
In terms of your personal evolution from going from wardrobe styling and internalizing all of that negativity. How have you got from there to kind of growing in confidence? And when did you sort of stumble across the body positivity movement? Is that one of the reasons that you are more confident today?
Oh, most definitely. So I went to New York in 2013 for my birthday. I went for a month and a bit. It was my first time going to America on my own. I just went and rented out like an Airbnb for a month because I just wanted a different environment. I was at my lowest emotionally and mentally, and I just wanted a bit of a break. And I went to New York, and in the neighborhood that I was in, every morning I'd go out and just walk around and explore the neighborhood. And I would always see these women, plus size women, just looking amazing. Like, they were wearing crop tops and bodycon dresses, and they were just so confident. And here was me, and it was like in the middle of May, and it was hot, and I was wearing a cardigan, and I was just like, what is stopping me from looking like them? And, you know, they looked absolutely incredible. And I thought to myself, do you know what? When I come back to the UK, I really need to start working on my self-esteem, because these women are shaped similarly to me, but they're not letting their size get in the way of their confidence. And so I came back to the UK and I tried to start working on myself. I really did try, but obviously with body positivity and body confidence, it's not linear. There will always be times when you don't like yourself or you have like a bad day. And so the following year, 2014, I went to Barcelona for my birthday again. And this was the first time I was going to a beach. And I thought to myself, well, in order to go to the beach, I need to have a bikini body. Like, I can't go on the beach looking like this. And so I remember in January, I decided to go on a diet. And I just did all of these things that are just really, really harmful to my body. So it was a case of, you know, sometimes not eating, or I would get diet pills that weren't even like legal in the UK. Like, I don't want to go into all of the stuff that I did, just but I did like a lot of things that helped me to lose the weight very, very quickly, but it was extremely dangerous and detrimental to my mental health. So I was in Barcelona and I'd lost about 4 stone in about 3 months. Yeah, it was the stuff that I was doing was terrible. And I was in Barcelona with this flat tummy, and I was just looking at myself in the mirror, and I was just like, my mental health is just terrible. Like, I can't believe that all my body does is fight to keep me alive, and I've been treating it like utter rubbish. And I just broke down, and I came back after my holiday, and I was like, I can't continue to live my life like this, because my body has done nothing wrong. It's literally just existing, and I'm just treating it so horribly. If my body was another person, I would never talk or treat my body the way I do to it now. So then that was the point where I was like, okay, I'm gonna seriously try and incorporate self-care into my daily routine. And then that was when I stumbled across the body positivity community on Tumblr and Instagram. And it was primarily...
And this is in which year are we in now?
This is 2014. Okay. So this is where I stumbled across the community, and it was primarily American bloggers at the time. And then it slowly came over to the UK. Yeah, and then that's where my life kind of changed. And then we had brands such as ASOS launching their Curve range, which was just monumental for me, because that was one of the first brands that created current stylish trendy clothing for plus size women. And I just went mad, and I just started buying all the things, and that was kind of where it all started for me in terms of like my confidence and documenting my body positivity trials and tribulations.
Do you remember how old you were when you first felt uncomfortable in your body or started hating your body?
Yes, I was 11. So I was in secondary school, just started year 7, and I was in the changing rooms, and it was like communal changing rooms, like the girls' communal changing rooms. And I just remember looking around. All of us were going through puberty at the time, and I just remember just being bigger than everybody else, and all of the girls would like stare at me, and it made me feel very othered. It made me feel very different. And I was bullied in secondary school from the first day because of my surname, and all the boys wanted to take the piss out of it, I suppose. But then the bullying began to get a lot more intense and it turned physical. And so because I was quite quiet as a child, I never mentioned that I was getting bullied, but it lasted up until year 11. And it was during that time that I was diagnosed with depression, just because I wasn't telling the people around me that I was getting bullied. And it was all to do with my weight and how I looked and how dark my skin was and things like that. And so that was when I really began like hating how I looked and not wanting to be here and hating, you know, everything about my physical appearance.
Do you think that you were indirectly affected by your contemporaries at school absorbing advertising that only saw one type of body and ethnicity?
Yes, definitely. So growing up, I don't feel like I had any role models or people that I could look up to within the media and advertising. I definitely didn't really see any plus size women. I didn't see any plus size women of colour or black plus size women at all. I just felt very much like I was the only person that was going through this. I was the only girl that looked this way, and therefore that must mean that I am less than everybody else. And I'm just trying to think of like who was in vogue at the time. 2000. I can't remember who was like the it girl at the time, but might have been Kate Moss, I can't remember, but
she was the it girl for a long time, wasn't she?
She was the it girl for a long time. Like Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, those were the idols that we had at the time. And so I remember actually in secondary school, there was this trend where all the girls were getting like blonde hair and then getting like red and blue highlights in their hair because of like there was a Christina Aguilera video where she had like highlights and it was like low cut jeans and like midriff tops. And I would just stare because I knew that I couldn't participate in it because one, clothing wasn't made for women that look like me or girls that look like me, and two, I knew that I would just feel ridiculous in it because people would stare. And I think if I had that positive representation within the media growing up, I would feel a lot more secure in who I was.
As the body positivity movement has escalated in the UK from kind of 2014, what we're seeing quite a lot of is thin privilege within body positivity, which actually I read a post about recently, which was saying that although you may hate yourself as a thin person and hate every part of your body, it's not a privileged position to be in, but you have the privilege of being in a body that is just not going to experience the external forces that you would have if you were in a plus size body. And I feel that there can be quite a heated debate on social media where everyone says that they want to get to the same goal, but you obviously are more educated and you always like to talk about stuff like this from a position of education rather than from a position of anger. So what are your views on that?
So I think there are two separate things here. There's the body positivity movement as a political movement that goes back from the 60s, and then it kind of was a bit dormant for a while, and then it reignited again on social media, primarily in America, from about 2009, 2010 onwards. So that's the current body positivity wave movement that we're on. And then there was the case of self-love and body confidence and things like that. And I think because of the way body positivity is named, it just sounds very, very broad. But I think what people should know is that body positivity is in the current movement that we have at the moment did stem from the fat acceptance movement, which was created by plus size black women in America. And it was normally seen on things such as Tumblr and Instagram and Facebook groups. And then as it became a lot more mainstream, then for some reason, I'm not sure why or when it happened, but women started using body positivity hashtags on Tumblr and Instagram. And so that was kind of how the body positivity movement was created. So it was a safe space for fat bodies to celebrate themselves and to lift themselves up and to highlight themselves. What we're seeing at the moment is that it's now very mainstream, which is good. However, I think what has been lost is the fact that this political movement was for exclusively fat bodies or bodies that fall outside the realms of what society considers beautiful. It was our safe space to kind of celebrate our bodies and do all of these things. And now we have sort of everybody using the body positivity hashtag and things like that. And I've always said that you should be able to feel however you feel about your body, and your feelings are valid. So even if you are slim or tall or, you know, however the case may be, if you are in a privileged body, you definitely have that right to feel however you feel about your body. And I don't think it's right that people are villainized for feeling that way about their body, even if they are in a privileged body. But they do also have to accept that you don't have the same pressures that plus size women do when it comes to how society treats us. You can be confident in your body. You are allowed to have, you know, body confidence, body acceptance, but it's not the same as the political movement of body positivity, which is a specific movement that was spearheaded by unprivileged bodies. So I think that's just the main difference between the two, is that, you know, I think if body positivity was still called fat acceptance, then it wouldn't be as mainstream as it would be. But because the name is very vague, it's almost become an umbrella term for everybody to use. But I think it's important that people know the roots of body positivity and who it's for, because we are at a moment now where the movement has completely eradicated and almost forgotten the people that created it. And it's now making space for women that are maybe curvy at best, normally white, very attractive, high cheekboned, flat tummied women. That seems to be who takes up the space within this movement. And while that's great, I think there needs to be more emphasis on the women whose bodies don't get that limelight and that shine. So you can love yourself and you can be all of these things and raise yourself up and have these support systems as somebody in a privileged body, but then equally don't let it be a thing where it's co-opting a movement that was already set in place for unprivileged bodies.
That's probably easier to articulate that than in a series of tweets. So it's like, yeah. If anyone comes back to you, you can just point them in the direction of the podcast. But there you go.
Yes.
As you mentioned, it has become more mainstream and thus very marketable for brands. Mm-hmm. In terms of diversity, that is what's been on many brands' agendas. Do you think that brands are necessarily being authentic, and where is the risk of tokenism in that?
It's a really interesting one, because on one hand, I think it's absolutely wonderful that there are so many brands highlighting body positivity and including bigger bodies and things like that in their marketing, because it then gives bodies that aren't privileged the opportunity to buy clothes and to have a lot more options when it comes to clothing. Like 2014, I think it was like 3 shops that did plus size, and now we've got loads and loads and loads of shops because of how huge body positivity has become. Equally, it does feel like there are some brands that are just co-opting the movement because it's a bit of a moneymaker. So I do feel like sometimes there can be brands that they say that they are for body positivity, but they don't necessarily walk in that truth. So they will use plus size bodies, but they will use plus size bodies up to a size 16 or up to a size 18. And they use these size 16, size 18 models to model clothes that are like a size 24, 26 onwards. So what they're doing isn't necessarily representing their audience. And I think in order to be truly authentic as a brand, you need to talk the talk and walk the walk. So if you say that you're going to be inclusive as a brand, you need to make sure that your brand, whether you're a plus size brand or if you're like a mainstream size brand, if your brand starts at like a size 6, then make sure you go up to like a size 28 or like a size 30. I don't think that there should be a cutoff point. And I just feel like in terms of the tokenism, again, that is definitely a thing. I think not enough women of colour, black women, are being used within the body positivity movement, especially considering it was women of colour that created the movement and who spearheaded the movement.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think, because if I think about how body positivity is received in America, it's a lot different than in the UK. And that just may well be because there's a lot more people in America. When I see the influencers being used and the women that are being used in advertising for body positivity in America, it's really good. Like, they always have a diverse mix of models and influencers from all backgrounds. But in the UK, it just seems body positivity is very white. And it almost kind of reminds me of, you know, this whole white feminism thing that we're seeing at the moment where, you know, feminism is a great thing, but it's not intersectional. And I think body positivity is the same. It's not intersectional. We still haven't broken that mold yet. There are quite a few plus size bloggers of colour in the UK who don't get used or rarely get used for campaigns. And yeah, it just kind of seems that for a movement that promotes diversity and inclusivity, it's not really that diverse or inclusive at all. So I feel like in order to be seen as a good body positive role model, brands have a certain type that they like to use. And it's normally, you know, somebody that has an hourglass shape. Normally they're white. Normally they have high cheekbones. Normally they have a big bum or they have big boobs and a small waist. And that is the acceptable fat for body positivity. That is the template that brands like to use because it's acceptable to the masses. And it doesn't sit well with me at all, because if you are going to be truly body positive, you have to use people of all backgrounds, and you can't keep using privileged fat bodies to represent a whole arena of people who fall outside of what that privilege is. So
do you think brands are too frightened to ask those questions and don't want to publicly do that research for fear of being labelled as stuff? Because I think what we're seeing with social media now is things can escalate so fast that people fear about asking questions which could lead to them being educated for being, you know, labelled all different things. What do you think?
I think a lot of it has to do with the public as well, like the public's perception of a brand. So there are times when I would go onto maybe like a Facebook group of a plus size brand or a mainstream brand, and that brand has used a plus size person on their grid. But it's not like an acceptable plus size person. It's like somebody that's a lot bigger, or they're disabled, or there's something about them that makes them stand out. And you kind of scroll through the comments and you read the comments, and it's absolutely horrible. And I have witnessed sometimes brands just deleting that picture because they don't like the backlash of the comments that they're getting. And sometimes those comments do come from fellow plus size women as well, which is really remarkable to me. And for me, it kind of, it says to me that maybe that person isn't comfortable in themselves. So they're kind of offshooting their insecurity onto this person that is very confident. But I think brands really need to sort of take a stand and say, you know, we want to cater to all women, or, you know, all people, and we're going to start using women that reflect our audience. And at the moment, there's only one plus size brand that I can think of that goes the extra mile to incorporate all bodies, all sizes. They even, you know, use readers to model some of their clothes. They use influencers of all backgrounds to model their clothes. And it is quite sad, you know, because I feel like sometimes brands are just scared of being labelled. They might be scared of being labelled as a brand that is promoting obesity, or it's promoting this, or it's promoting that. And they may not think that the way we look is a good representation of their brand, but we deserve to kind of have those same clothes and have that same representation as well.
You talked about brands co-opting the body positivity movement. I've noticed a spike in thin, white, able-bodied people on social media talking about diversity wherever they can. And so from a personal experience, we had the Blogosphere Awards last June, and we received a tweet from the aforementioned saying, "Oh, Blogosphere, there are no black people nominated in any of the awards." And, you know, it's not true, but I don't want to also go online and point people out being like, actually, they're black, because that's not why the nominees were selected. It wasn't based on that. And it makes you, I don't know, it's frustrating, because I think, yes, we need to have a movement and discussion, but you also need to be doing your research before you're starting labelling. And, you know, from that tweet can suddenly turn into something else.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I'm pretty sure I was nominated and a couple of other, I did see, yeah, it was,
but when, you know,
very
it's
diverse.
Not box, it's not box ticking either.
Yeah, and that's the danger sometimes, because sometimes from another point of view, sometimes it's an interesting question, because where is the line between ticking a box to be diverse, but then also genuinely choosing people because of their merit and their content. And there are some brands that do that really well in terms of they just choosing people because they love their content. And then there are some brands or publications who are just choosing specific people because they're Black or because they're Asian or something like that, and it's to fill a quota. But then it's like, you just never really know, unless it's very, very obvious, you just never really know what the intentions are. I think in terms of people that are privileged speaking about diversity, I personally, I do welcome it. So I tend to get a lot of questions from privileged people about diversity. So they'll ask me, you know, how comes I can't say this, or how comes body positivity is for you, but it's not for me. And I'm always more than happy to talk about it and explain to them, because a lot of people genuinely don't know. And I think it's really good to educate. But then I feel like, and this is a really sad thing, actually, that I was speaking to one of my friends who's also an influencer. She's also, you know, tall white woman, very beautiful, and she often speaks a lot about the lack of diversity within plus size influencing. And I've always appreciated her doing that, because we know each other personally. I know that she genuinely cares about equal representation. She's also gone as far to say, as you know, if she is approached for a campaign, she puts in her contract that she wants it to be equal. She doesn't want it to be just all white. So I think there are ways to talk about body positivity as somebody who is privileged without co-opting it. And what's sad is that sometimes we kind of need these privileged bodies to speak about body positivity, because they won't listen to me, or they won't listen to other Black women or other plus size women that are a lot bigger. Sometimes it has to come out of the voice of the privileged person.
For Body Posy Panda talks about that a lot. It's like, people are listening to me because of my privilege.
Yeah, and I've seen that so many times. There have been so many occasions where I have spoken about specific things, or I've said something and I've received a lot of backlash, and I talk about the backlash. Like, I'll get people talking to me and saying, you know, I'm sorry that happened to you. But then somebody else will go through it at a smaller scale, and they will talk about it, and then suddenly it's on all the headlines. This person was bullied because of this online. And I sit back and I'm just like, it's just interesting who chooses the stories or who chooses the mouthpieces to listen to. It is quite sad that in order for me to get a point across, or in order for somebody in the community who isn't white or, you know, acceptably fat to get their point across, we need to have these allies to speak on behalf of us. And it shouldn't be like that. But sometimes I can't see any other way of us getting our point across. So I think it's important for allies to, you know, speak up, but just don't overspeak for us. So you can kind of use your position to retweet other women of colour, or retweet their blog posts, or retweet their latest pictures, or just uplift the women that you follow in that space. So sometimes it's not a case of talking over them or making it about your specific situation. Sometimes it's just a retweet. Sometimes it could do a world of wonder, or like a cosign or something like that, you know?
On social media, there are quite a few groups that are, say, sort of like Black beauty bloggers. What are... And you've spoken about having allies that maybe traditional mainstream press are more interested in listening to. Do you think the cultivation of groups that are based solely on ethnicity are important? And what would you say to the people that see that more as kind of reinforcing colour lines?
I think it is important, because especially when it comes to being an influencer and the opportunities that we get in contrast to maybe like white influencers, Black influencers in the UK, we are not that well represented at all. We're always the last picked when it comes to like beauty or fashion campaigns. There was a study that came out a few years ago that Black women actually spend the most amount of money on makeup every year. We have to, because high street brands don't really make makeup for us, so we always have to go premium. So there's a huge market for beauty brands to use Black influencers, but we are rarely used. So we get to see all of the brand trips and the brand campaigns. And a few of us have noticed, you know, we go onto the Instagrams and we see the girls that are being taken on these trips and going to these dinners and campaigns, and they're all white. And so I think it's important to kind of have these groups where we can talk about ways in which we can, I guess, make our content stand out, or ways in which we can empower each other and just lift each other up, because it can be really demoralizing when you've been working at content for so long and yet you're always passed over a lot of the time, or some of the time, because of how dark your skin is or because you're not white. Or, and it's a quite a popular saying within like a lot of Black and Asian communities, is that we always have to work twice as hard to get half as much in general. And it really does seem to be the case. And so I do completely understand when there are these race specific communities, because we're not supported in the general sphere of things. So we need to have those tight communities where we can get to know each other and network and make friends and just try and work out how we can get these mainstream brands and publications to notice us as women that have good content to give to the world.
Do you think part of the problem is unconscious bias, because the decision makers at these brands and those teams will by default be seeing people similar to themselves on social media, and then it kind of filters down?
Yeah, definitely. I think in order to incite change, in order to enact change, we need to have a much more diverse range of people behind the scenes. So whether it's casting directors or PRs or decision makers within brands, publications, TV, media, all of these things, there needs to be a lot more diversity, because otherwise you will have this ongoing stream of people just choosing people that look like them and thinking, well, this is our audience, this is what I cater to, and this is, you know, all they see is, you know, this specific color, and they just assume that people that fall outside of that aren't buying into this product, when a lot of the time it's not the case. And going back to the brand that I was talking about a few moments ago, about the brand that always goes, you know, all out for plus size women of all shapes and colors, the reason that that brand is amazing is because the PR and the social editor for that brand is plus size. And since she's been there, she's completely just changed the whole scope of how she interacts with bloggers and influencers and things like that. And normally they're always sort of heralded as one of the best brands to work with, because it just makes such a change having somebody that is plus size working there. And I think the same needs to go for race as well. If we can't...
Is that ASOS or Simply Be?
Oh, this is Navabi.
Okay.
Navabi, yeah. So Navabi are such a great, great brand to work with. And I think they're just such an example of having somebody that is just different, just behind the scenes, because then you get to have their insight and you get to have their expertise. So last January, there was the whole thing with the coolest monkey in the jungle thing. And that was actually something that I tweeted out. And I didn't at the time know that I was the first one to tweet it. So it was a bit intense. It was a bit crazy. But that's an example of, you know, decision makers just QCing a product. And I think it came out that the decision makers or people within the marketing team or the creative team, they were all white. They didn't know that that could potentially be, yeah, have that sort of racial triggering link, because to them it's just, oh, it's just, you know, a monkey in the jungle. And then they decided to put it on a black boy, and, you know, the resulting backlash ensued. And it kind of felt like they didn't really understand what was wrong. And I think if you have people in these areas that can sort of QC almost before something goes out, then it would be a lot more fairer.
What do you think in terms of improvement in inclusivity? Do you think that we have seen success and that on the whole it is moving to a better thing, or do you feel it's stagnated?
I still feel it's a bit stagnated, just because I haven't really seen that much progress, if I'm being completely honest. In terms of where clothing is concerned, having more options, there is definitely progress there, because there are brands that are still steadily, you know, increasing their lines to incorporate bigger sizes. So that's always going to be a plus, and that's something that I wouldn't take away from that. But in terms of the representation side and the representation of models and influencers, and there hasn't been that inclusivity there. And I think the UK is really behind on that front, because the US, who, you know, a lot may say are significantly a lot more when it comes to racial tension, they're a lot more intense, but yet they seem to be a lot more diverse and a lot more inclusive. And that kind of says something about the way we, I guess, navigate different ethnicities and bloggers here. I think a lot more can be done. I think the tokenism aspect needs to stop. I don't think it's right that, you know, and I've used this term on Twitter before, but sometimes I feel like they kind of like sprinkle us on like parsley at the end of a meal just for it to look a little bit more colourful. So sometimes if a brand does use a black woman or a black man, they're always light skinned with like really wavy hair. They're never like darker skinned and big or disabled or anything like that. It's always, always light skinned. So it's always that preference to being lighter or being white. And that is seen as acceptable. And I think brands just need to go out on a limb and be, I don't even want to call it brave, because it shouldn't be brave for brands to just use a diverse group of people, but there just needs to be a lot more work done.
Do you think that sometimes, because we're in sort of the London bubble and like 55% of London is non-white, but in the rest of the UK, maybe it is whiter. So brands are trying to think of it.
That's true. That's true. I think that could definitely have some impact.
Do you think the root of the problem is people just want to see people like themselves? Or do you think that's just what advertisers think people want to think?
I think
that's a very big question.
Yeah, I think advertisers think that's what people want to think. And I just think it's funny that a lot of advertisers, especially within fashion, there's been this trend over the past couple of years, and I think they know what they're doing. They go onto social media and they look at all the newest slang words and all of these, you know, things like bae and all of that stuff. And it's all from black slang, and they incorporate it into their marketing. So they use all of these slang words to appeal to the youth, but it's all taken from black culture. And, you know, this happens in general anyway, not just like black or plus size community, but in general, where you'll have brands or corporations that take a lot from a specific culture because they know that it sells.
Yeah.
But then they don't actually want to use the bodies to portray that. And I think there's something quite insidious in that you find it okay to take something from culture because you know that it's cool, but then you don't want to use the bodies that are available, and instead you will use another body and darken their skin, or you will intentionally make their hair a lot more afro-like when that's not the case. It's a bit insidious, and I do wish some brands would stop doing that, because sometimes it's just like, okay, so you're really tapping into the black culture here, but yet all of your models are white, all of your advertising is white, like why are you not using the people representative of this culture to sell your items?
When it's not for like monetary gain, but say like the term bae that has kind of infiltrated all kind of cultures in the UK now, is that a negative thing, or is that just showing that lines are blurring, which is positive?
I don't think it's negative per se.
I can understand when you're taking something from a different culture and then not
like appropriating.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? I think from my point of view, it's amusing to me when I see people using terminology from black culture or things like that, because I feel like, you know, 10, 20 years ago, they wouldn't have used it at all, or this style of having big bums and big lips and all of these things that black women were, you know, harassed for and being shamed for are now in fashion. But then the way that it's come back in fashion is that it's only in fashion if white women have it, and if black women have it, it's like, I don't really care. You know, if it comes under something that is termed as acceptable and westernized, then it's great. So when I do see it, I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I just think, oh, we're finally like in fashion. I just think it's important as well when, if you are going to use specific words or phrases or things like that, just sometimes be a bit careful, or research the words. And, you know, there was this whole thing on Twitter a few weeks ago where an influencer demonized a specific word, and she didn't know where the word came from. It was like black lingo, and she said something quite derogatory about it. She was quite a huge influencer, and the backlash was just really intense, to the point where she deleted her account temporarily. And I just think...
Do you think that culture of backlash is detrimental?
So like the cancel culture?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do have a problem with cancel culture, because I feel like sometimes not everything needs to be cancelled. Sometimes you just need to explain something to somebody, because I do genuinely feel like sometimes people will just not know. And if you're so involved in the culture, sometimes you live in a bubble and you just tend to assume that, oh, because everybody's on Twitter, everybody should know what this means, or everybody will know what this means. And Twitter and Instagram and these sorts of social media platforms are so, when you do think about it, if you are interacting with the same 100, 150 people a week, it can feel really small. So you just assume that everybody knows what you're talking about. And sometimes there are people that come from different backgrounds and they just literally have no clue what it is. And so with me personally, I always try to involve myself as a way to educate instead of point the finger.
A safe person to be able to talk to and inform.
Yeah, I don't think sometimes just sort of going in with all guns blazing and automatically accusing them of this, sometimes it can be really detrimental and it can make that person feel a sense of anxiety almost. And so I don't believe in doing that unless what the person has said is just so, like, you can tell they're either trolling or they've said it in such a way that you just know that there's no way that they could have said that in a nice way. But aside from that, if somebody is genuinely questioning something or they've said something and they just didn't know what it was, then I don't like this whole cancel culture. And I think the same with this new trend of bringing up people's old tweets from like 2007, 2008. Like, I just feel like people change. You know, it was happening with, you know, celebrities, and I saw it happening with influencers. And I was just like, and I've said this before on my Twitter, pre-2014, I was terrible. I was just bad. Like, I used to talk about smegma all the time. Oh my gosh, I was just the worst. And I actually said this when somebody else was exposed at the time. I was just like, look, I'm not going to get caught out. I'm just going to retweet all of my old tweets and let it be done. So that's what I did. I just retweeted all the things and I was just like, can do what you want with it. And nobody really said anything, but people change as we get older. All of us, when we were tweeting all of these things, we were like, what, 18, 19, some of us 17, 16 and younger. And yeah, we were trash. And yeah, we could have, you know, it was during a time when we're not as woke as we are now. So I feel like sometimes just give people that leniency and give people the opportunity to learn and grow from their mistakes, because there are some things that I tweeted and said that I would never say now, but back then I just didn't have a clue and I would just be reckless and say whatever I want. And people grow and people change, so they're not necessarily going to have the same views now as they did back then before they received the education and became a lot more socially aware. Because I think we have to recognize that millennials, we are kind of the first generation that are becoming a lot more socially aware, and we're aware of social justice issues and we take all of these things into account and we're trying to become a lot more woke. Before that, it was anything goes. People would just say whatever they want and nobody really would react because it was just, you know, that's the power of free speech, I guess. But we still have to take into account that it's still a generation that's still growing and we're still trying to, you know, some of us do have to catch up with that, you know? So I don't think the cancel culture is doing any kind of
favours, yeah.
Any favours at all.
Are you glad that you didn't have social media when you were at school? And how, you know, go back to that girl in the changing room first deciding to not like their body.
Mm.
How escalated and accelerated is that, do you think, with social media for children? And finally, on that point, if you could go back now to the girl in the changing room, what would you say?
I'm very glad that I didn't have social media at school. And I frankly, I do feel sorry for today's youth. I can't believe I'm saying that. I feel so old. Today's youth, because it just follows you home. Back when I was at school and I was getting bullied and all of these things, I would go home, I would be alone or lonely, but I wouldn't have that hammering at me, you know, from 5 p.m. onwards. Whereas now you have that pressure, people finding your Instagram or your social media and hacking it or exposing you or bullying you via those realms. And there's just so much pressure. And equally, there's so much pressure to look a certain way as well because of social media. So while social media would be good in terms of body positivity and finding that community and involving yourself in that community and curating your feeds, the negative of that is that you are exposed to so much in terms of beauty ideals and everybody wants to look like Kylie Jenner and there are all these tutorials on how to look a certain way. And it's like, 11-year-olds shouldn't be tweezing their eyebrows or threading their eyebrows. Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe this is just me sounding really old, but I just go out and just play Pokemon or do something. Like, I just, it is quite a shame. And I think if I was to go back and, you know, talk to the girl in the changing rooms who felt less than everyone else, I would just say, just hang in there. it will get better. And I know it's such a cliche phrase. It's such a cliche phrase. And I didn't believe it up until a point as well, but it will get better. And you are worthy of love. You are worthy of respect. And you are beautiful. And don't let anybody's narrow-minded judgments get in the way of you living your best life.
A big thanks to Steph for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Be sure to check out blogospheremagazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?